located at 800 East Burnside Street, less than 1 mile from the Convention and Moda Centers, and Jupiter Next, a 67-room independent boutique hotel. Booking and more information online at jupiterhotel.com.
Join K Boo by December 31st and receive free gifts and prizes from the Give Guide. Just click the donate banner on the K Boo app to keep community radio strong and vibrant in Portland and beyond.
K Boo Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor at Portland's Folk Festival on Friday, January 10th and Saturday, January 11th, 6 to midnight at the Crystal Ballroom in Portland. Portland's Folk Festival is an all-ages celebration of folk and Americana music in Portland. Friday performers include Anna Tivolt, Cedar Teeth, Glitter Fox, and more. Saturday performers include Horse Feathers, The Get Ahead, and more. Again, that's Portland's Folk Festival, Friday, January 10th, and Saturday, January 11th, from 6 to midnight at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
When we meet, there won't be winter.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. On our show today, we'll spend the hour discussing plastic production and the resulting pollution. First, we'll examine a study that found massive pollution in our drinking water. Chris Tyree, lead author of the report called Invisibles, The Plastic Inside Us, will join us. Then Carol Moffat with the Center for International Environmental Law will discuss his study calling for an end to single-use plastics. It's called Plastic and Climate, The Hidden Costs of a Plastic Planet. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. A new and terrifying global study of drinking water has found massive contamination by microscopic plastic fibers. The study is the first of its kind and identifies previously unknown contamination of water flowing out of faucets in cities as far away as New Delhi and as close by as Washington, D.C. The origins of the microscopic fibers is still being debated and its impact on human health still unknown. However, animal studies indicate that it's likely not a good thing for so many of us to be ingesting so much plastic. My guest is Chris Tyree. He is a journalist with Orb Media and lead author of the article entitled Invisibles, The Plastic Inside Us, which covers the study. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Yes. So I suppose we shouldn't be surprised at how pervasive plastic is in our water, given that it is literally all around us. What prompted this study? Where did you get the idea to even approach this issue? Where did scientists, figure out that this was something that needs to be examined?
Right, that's a great question. You know, a few years ago, we had scientific studies done on the Great Lakes and determined that they were filled with microbeads. And that led to bipartisan legislation passing banning microbeads in cosmetics. And so we started looking at that and a couple other angles on this story, and we really realized that nobody's really done a very in-depth study on all the microplastics.
Microbeads being the sort of things that you found in these hand washes or facial, you know, exfoliants, where instead of salt or whatever would be a natural exfoliant, manufacturers were literally adding tiny plastic beads, which on the face of it sounded like a terrible idea, but people bought the stuff.
Right. You know, when they were invented, I think they had no idea that they would have been used quite the way they were. Some microbeads are very useful in treating cancer. So there is an upside to them sometimes. But when they did the study and they realized just how pervasive microbeads were in the Great Lakes and then in subsequent studies all over the world, it started becoming an alarming number, because they're not being filtered out. And I think that's sort of where we kind of took a cue from. If they're not being filtered out in the wastewater treatment plants, what makes us think they're being filtered out when they come back into our waterways, right, into our water filtration systems? So we started looking at all the different ways that, you know, all these different kinds of microplastics, from the microbeads to microfibers that come from synthetic clothing to tire dust is made of, tires are mostly, not natural rubber anymore. They're a type of plastic. Even paints, acrylic paints, nobody really thought to think, oh, wow, I just cleaned my paintbrush straight down the drain. Well, all that paint is really just acrylic microplastics, really. And nobody's really even done much on that, frankly. So when we started digging in and we realized that there's this kind of untold story around microplastics, we were interviewing one of the lead researchers, a guy named Mark Brown out of Australia, who was the first to really see, determine that microfibers were probably even more pervasive than microbeads. And during that this sort of pre-reporting interview I was doing with him, he said, I'm having a hard time getting a clean blank from my tap in my lab to be able to run my studies. I have to filter the water coming out of my tap numerous times in order to have a very clean sample with no microplastics.
Just to compare it to like a controlled sample.
Exactly, a controlled sample. And that kind of like, that's where the light bulb went off. And I'm like, oh my God, if this researcher is having a hard time getting clean water out of his faucet in his lab in Sydney, Australia, what makes me think that that's not coming out of my faucet here in Charlottesville, Virginia? Because ORB is this amazing, we're a small organization, but we have a very strong model of how we tell stories and how we use data and how we use social journalism to be legs of a stool that help us report our stories. And so we devised this study to look at tap water. We could get citizen scientists to sample water around the world, because we have a great network. But we knew we needed a key to oversee this. And so we went back to the same researcher who did the work in the Great Lakes, who found those microbeads, Dr. Sherry Mason, who's she's pretty renowned in the field of microplastic research. And so she agreed to oversee this study. And we worked with a researcher named Erica Suth from the University of Minnesota, and we sampled 159 locations from around the world. And you're right, it was pretty alarming what we found.
Let's actually watch a short video from that was part of your reporting in ORB Media before we get to what the results were. My guest is Chris Tyree, journalist with ORB Media, and here is a short video explaining where this plastic oil might be coming from.
Less than 100 years ago, chemists first began to bend and reorder petroleum molecules into a lightweight substance that could be molded into just about any form. Since then, inventors have created hundreds of different plastics, and industry has found millions of uses for them. Today, more than 322 million tons of plastic are produced each year, up from just 1.5 million tons in the 1950s. If plastic was a country, it would be the world's 20th largest economy, bigger than those of Austria, Argentina, Egypt, and dozens of others. The world wants plastic. Look around you right now. Look at your home, your office, your street, and try to count the plastic articles. How high did you reach before giving up? That's just the stuff you can see. Beyond the naked eye is a realm of invisible plastic. On purpose and by accident, fibers, fragments, and chemicals infiltrate every aspect of daily life. Every start and stop of every car sends microscopic particles of styrene tire dust wafting into the air. Each wash of every single synthetic garment releases up to 1,900 microscopic plastic fibers into waterways. Every rinse of every paintbrush sends liquid plastic down the drain. Every straw and plastic bottle that rides the ocean waves will break down into fragments smaller than the diameter of a human hair. Plastic doesn't go away. It only gets smaller.
And that's a short video produced by Orb Media about the article that we're discussing with my guest, Chris Tyree. The article is entitled Invisibles, the Plastic Inside Us. Wow. So plastic is literally everywhere. What were the cities whose tap water was tested? And what did you find? Is there a place on Earth where one doesn't find plastic in one's water?
Well, we don't know the answer to that last question. It would surprise me if we didn't find it everywhere, to be honest. We took samples from 5 different continents in multiple cities. So Quito, Ecuador, London, Paris, New York, Berlin, Jakarta, many, many samples. And then they're all sort of listed on our website under our report. We're very transparent about the study. It is the paper that is going to be written off of this study by Mary Kasuth will eventually go into peer review sometime in the next 6 to 9 months. It's hard to say how long that process normally takes. The fundamental results are pretty alarming. And we had no idea. We went out in the field. We really didn't know what we would expect. We went out reporting before we actually had the results of the study. And so when we got back and we started doing our production, and we realized finally that, oh my gosh, this is actually staggering, these numbers.
And is there a difference between, you know, rural communities versus urban communities? Is there a difference between developing countries or developed countries?
We found the rate of microplastics in the United States higher than anywhere else. So,
so the U.S. higher than anywhere else, higher than New Delhi.
Correct. I mean, you have to keep in mind the sample size. There are literally millions of taps around the world, but we were very particular. We wanted to know, is this in people's drinking water? It doesn't matter where you live in the world. Is it in your drinking water? Because, you know, the ethos of Orb is we're a global community. Communication has shrunk our world. And we have this story that we all have to, that we share. We share our human story. And water is a necessity for life. So it was kind of a no-brainer that we would look at this in this manner from our perspective at Orb. But
So what's the level of contamination we're talking about here? Explain it. You know, if I get a glass of water from my faucet in Southern California, what might I expect that I am ingesting at that very moment?
It's really hard to say. It really does depend. But I can tell you this. The studies are pretty clear that there's plastic coming out of your faucet. And whether those are microfibers or other microparticles that we didn't even examine, there's likely plastic in it. The proliferation is just it's just amazing. It's just like we have so much plastic. So the level of contamination coming out of that faucet in sunny California, I mean, you're not just using that for drinking. I mean, you're using it for cooking. You're using it to make baby formula. We use water for everything, and we can't live without it. So how much you're actually getting, it's hard to determine. And the implications that for human health, scientists are still trying to figure that out.
So let's talk about, if these are microscopic, if they are making it through filters, could they be making it through skin, through our stomach lining, getting into our organs, right? Because if these particles are so tiny that we don't really have filters that will capture them, then maybe when we drink water, they're getting into our liver, our kidney, our endocrine system, our brains?
You know, these are very, very good questions.
And I mean, I'm terrified just asking you this because I don't want to know the answer.
Right. We need to know the answer, though, right? I mean, for us and for our future generations, we cannot leave them a planet that is contaminated. And, you know, we're living in the plastic age. We have passed the computer age. We're totally in the plastic age. If you look around you, I bet within 2 feet of you, you've got 500 things that are made of plastic. We depend on it every day. It's not a horrible product in and of itself. I mean, it's so useful. It makes our lives, you know, so much easier in so many ways. But we've become addicted to it. And I think the next level of research really will need to look at the nanoplastics, what you were just talking about. Those, you know, we're looking at things, you know, in a scale down to the micron level that will go through tissue. The nanoparticles will go through human tissue, will go through cells. And the technology really isn't even there in many places to even study that. There are a few places that can do that, but it really is the next step, I think, in discovering just how far plastic has infiltrated our lives.
So the microbeads, we may have gotten under control by passing regulations that stop their use in sort of everyday cosmetic items. But the fibers, the video mentioned, and you also mentioned things like acrylic paint, the tires of cars. I was surprised by the idea of clothing, but it shouldn't be, because so much of our clothing today is synthetic. You know, I mean, natural fibers like wool or cotton are not as common as polyester. All those fleece jackets we'll be buying and, you know, or might already own, of course, for the winter, you know, socks, gloves, everything. So much of our clothing is synthetic, but we don't think about the fact that it's a byproduct of the petroleum industry. We don't link our clothing to oil from the ground. Is that possibly a very huge source of the origins of these microfibers, that every time we wash our clothes, we're releasing them into the water systems?
You're absolutely right. I mean, from the studies that we've read and reported on and the experts that we've spoken with, I mean, you're talking about maybe as much as 1 million tons a year of microfibers. Now, think about how small a fiber is to get to, and how many of those you would need to get to 1 million tons. Like, that is epic. And that is, and so that's what's being released into the waterways. So there's no doubt. But you know, we should back up and say, you know, it's also in the air. I have carpet in my house, and it's, you know, it's stain, you know, the stain resistant carpet. Well, that stain resistant carpet is synthetic, and every time I walk across the carpet with my shoes, I'm going to be releasing tiny bits of microplastic into the air. Same thing with furniture. So yeah, really, we've created a world that's fairly unsafe when you think about it, and our exposure to it. The question is, how much exposure is unhealthy?
Right. So let's talk about the impact on human health. I mentioned we don't quite know yet, right, what the impacts are, because it hasn't been studied. But the effect of plastic on animals, or some animals, some organisms, has been studied?
Correct. We spoke with a researcher named Chelsea Rockman, who's now in Toronto, and she did one of the first studies looking at the transmission of microplastics through shellfish and sort of gauging the health of that animal, and how long those microplastics would stay in the animal before they would get released back out. So we do know. We know, and that's those studies, that if the surface area of microplastics, even though they're small, is very large. And that is very good for absorbing toxins or bacteria that they might come in contact with. Now, there's a variety of different research showing, you know, how well that might happen, or how, you know, maybe it's not happening as much as we think it might be. But regardless, some of it is happening. And so those toxins are attaching to these these plastic particles and then being ingested by the lower parts of our food chain. I mean, all those things get eaten by bigger things, right? We eat plankton are eating it. We know that. You know, plankton are being eaten by a variety of different kinds of fish.
So people are kind of aware of, say, like mercury contamination in tuna. I'm wondering if the similar model applies, the same way we think of limiting our fish intake because we're worried about mercury content, and the bigger the fish, the bigger its cumulative effect. Is that similar to plastic?
That is a very good question. And I think the science is still out on that, about what amount of contamination, what amount of ingesting plastics is not healthy.
Right, because plastic lasts for practically ever, right? I mean, that's the biggest part of the issue, is that this is a material, and that's why it's so used, so ubiquitous all around, is because it doesn't wear down very much. I mean, our landfills are filled with plastic, and it'll be around for generations. So that's the advantage and the disadvantage.
Exactly. We've made more plastic in the last 10 years than in the last century combined. And if you think about that and the relationship we have to that, and now we know what we know we're doing to ourselves, and because it takes so long to break down, I mean, we're talking about this is going to be an issue for multiple generations. And you know, that's why it's sort of imperative. That's one of the reasons why we wanted to make this a global story, because it affects everybody all over the world, no matter where you live. And hopefully the story will spur more further research on this topic, and maybe even start to legislation, I think, is key. You know, hopefully it starts to get into the heads of people, like, we can't have a world without clean water. We can't survive as a species without clean water. And, even though we can't attribute a lot of recent studies, like, say, the rate of male infertility or testicular cancer rates to specific plastics, we do know that those things are sort of symptoms of the chemicals used to make those plasticizers. So will scientists ever be able to say, yes, you ate these fish, and because of that, you've got such cancer? Like, that's going to be nearly impossible to do, because we're, just the contamination level that we're all exposed to. But if we don't start doing something about that now, like, when will we, right? I mean, the red flags are up, and hopefully something will happen.
Well, Chris, a lot of times when people think about these sorts of studies, we want to take personal action to protect ourselves, even though, of course, political action is more effective, protects more people. But I can imagine some of my audience might be thinking, they tested tap water, I'm going to drink only plastic bottled water. And a lot of people still have this idea that bottled water is cleaner and safer than drinking water. So how do you address that issue? Because I understand that the study specifically looked at tap water, right? So what do you say to those people who might say, well, maybe bottled water is cleaner?
We did test 3 bottled water samples. Sort of at the very end of our study, we're like, we know now that it's in tap water. How about bottled water? And we sent 3 bottled water samples from 3 leading U.S. brands and found microfibers in those as well. If you go out and you buy bottled water, you're only contributing to the problem. Right. You're not solving it for yourself. You're still going to get plastic in you, but now you've also created more plastic in the environment that will eventually, I mean, there's only a fraction of plastic that even ends up in recycling bin. Another fraction that gets into our landfills, but the majority of it somehow escapes into our environment. And that's the plastic that's getting in us, right? So,
Is recycling plastic or greater rates of recycling going to be part of the sort of spectrum of solutions to this crisis?
I believe so. I mean, there are already, NGOs that are working on a circular plastic economy whereby, maybe we don't need, so we have 7 resin codes, right? You've seen those. Everybody thinks they're recycle codes, but they're really resin codes. It tells you basically what kind of plastic is in plasticizers making up the plastic that you're using at that moment. And we have a great graphic on our website to look at that really breaks that down and what the health effects could be from those particular kinds of plastics. But there are people like Richard Thompson, who's out of Plymouth University in England, who's working with trade to come up with a way to make, maybe it's just one single type of plasticizer that is recyclable, that's safe, and usable by all of industry. So we don't need all these other chemicals added to our plastics. And so, you know, it's going to, I think it will eventually come back to society saying, hey, this is an issue that I'm not comfortable with. I don't like that I'm giving my kid, you know, a bottle made with a formula that has plastic in it. So what am I going to do?
And honestly, even if you're breastfeeding your child, if you're drinking water that has plastic in it, your body might be contaminated. Who knows? I mean, I'm assuming at some point there might be some studies that might test breast milk for plastic microfibers. It's all around us. Yeah. It's all inside us.
So there is, I mean, there's already a study. It was done in, I believe, 1998 or maybe it was 2008, a few years ago, actually, that looked at babies being born contaminated. Ugh. And what they found is that babies are born with maybe 288 synthetic chemicals that would not be natural to them.
That so passes born, through the womb while they're in fetuses.
We're born contaminated, which is one of the reasons there's never going to be a human control group to be able to tell you what kind of cancer you get from having a certain plastic. And I think that's, that's probably the scariest part. Yeah. Is we can't wait though, right? We can't wait for those pieces of research because they'll never happen. It's too impossible.
Yeah, so, let's just actually clarify. I mean, when scientists do studies to try to find a correlation between disease and a certain contaminant, they have to compare it with something that's free of the contamination, run the same effects on both groups, the control group and the non-control group, in order to be able to come to a conclusion. But we will never be able to get a control group because there is so much plastic everywhere that we don't have a plastic-free environment to have a control sample. I mean, it's different from, say, linking smoking with with lung cancer, because you can find populations that don't smoke, but you can't find plastic-free populations.
Exactly.
All right, Chris, what about also humans, human beings, us, society, trying through our consumer power? I know it's tempting to use consumer pressure, but sometimes it can also be part of the spectrum of solutions, trying through our consumer power to just not buy so much plastic when there are non-plastic options such as glass or metal. We're talking about storage or cotton or wool when we're talking about clothing, that we should opt for those or buy used rather than brand new.
Exactly. And I think we have to be careful, like cotton and wool, like those have their own baggage with them as far as contamination.
Wait, what?
What is our personal responsibility? I think that's the biggest question. What can we do as in everyday life to minimize our exposure to plastics in the first place, and then hopefully prevent future generations from having to deal with such a large problem? The little stuff, and you see it all the time, is like, do we really need a straw to drink out of a glass?
Restaurants give straws all the time to people. It's just a standard thing. You get a glass of something and you're given a straw that's wrapped in paper, and then
wrapped in plastic around here.
That too.
I was saying this earlier, just taking the milk, your milk lid off of your milk jug, if you're using milk, there's a little piece of plastic that kind of binds that to the lid, right? That you don't want that seal broken. You wouldn't buy it if it was broken. However, that little seal, that little piece of plastic is going to last for 500 years or more. So we have to really limit how we think about our relationship to plastics and find ways to just cut down as much as possible, I think, wherever that can be. For me, that is, I take my own bags to the grocery store all the time. And I did that more before this story came out. Now, you know, I will casually, nicely put my straw back on the waiter's or waitress's tray, because it's, you know, we don't need those straws. And there are other things like that we can do. I launder my synthetic clothing half as much as I used to. I figure, you know, it's made to be worn. As long as it doesn't stink and it's not standing up by itself, then I'll keep wearing it until, like, you know, and I do one big load and I'll wash that. And I'll hang stuff out to dry if I can, versus putting it in a dryer, because the dryer is just sending those, whatever didn't come off in the wash is just sending that back out outside in the air. But we do have to take some personal responsibility.
Right. And reusing things rather than tossing them away. If you're buying a tub of yogurt, reuse the container instead of buying more Tupperware. I mean, simple things like that. There's so much we can do to keep the things that are made out of plastic lasting longer, because that's the best thing about plastic, is that it lasts a long time. So let's take advantage of that rather than disposing of them. Well, Chris, give out a website for Orb Media and where people can find out about the article and read about it.
Great. Well, www.orbmedia.org is our main website, and there you can learn all about us and all the different kinds of stories that we've worked on over the last few years. Our story is called Invisibles, The Plastic Inside Us, and that's one of the stories it's linked to on that main homepage.
That's orbmedia.org. Chris, thanks so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest is Chris Tyree, a journalist with Orb Media. He's the lead author of Invisibles, The Plastic Inside Us, and we've been discussing that new study and the article. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. There has been tremendous concern around the pollution of our oceans, our soil and food systems, and even our bodies from plastic waste. Now, a new study has examined a little discussed impact, how plastic waste exacerbates climate change. The Center for International Environmental Law produced the study called Plastic and Climate, the Hidden Costs of a Plastic Planet, and found, among other things, that, quote, the production and incineration of plastic will produce more than 850 million metric tons of greenhouse gases. That's equivalent to the emissions from 189 500 megawatt coal power plants. The report calls for an end to the production and use of single-use disposable plastic and the curtailing of new oil, gas, and petrochemical infrastructure. We turn to Carol Muffett, President and CEO of the Center for International Environmental Law. Welcome, Carol.
It's nice to be here.
So let's first talk about why this report examined this link. We, as I said, you know, there have been lots of studies on plastic pollution, how it's, you know, entering our food systems. It's even found in human bodies. It, of course, deeply impacts marine life. But is the climate impact of plastic an overlooked impact?
That is exactly right. And we set out to understand the scale of that impact. I think it's important to recognize that plastics are pervasive in our economy, they're pervasive in our lives, and they're pervasive in our environment. And as you said, there's been a growing awareness over the last many years that the impacts of plastics, particularly on ocean ecosystems, are completely unsustainable and in many cases catastrophic. There's also been a much slower but equally significant rising awareness that plastics are affecting human health at every stage of the plastics life cycle. So what CL set out to do, and we set out to do it with a number of partners, each of whom were experts in a specific aspect of that life cycle, was to understand what are the total climate impacts of our continued production and use and disposal of plastics and its release into the environment. Mm-hmm. And I'll say that what we found was really staggering. The scale of the impacts really surprised us. And it's important to recognize that plastics are simply fossil fuels in another form. 99% of what goes into plastics are oil, gas, and to a lesser extent, coal feedstocks. And as a result of this, you know, the processes that produce plastics begin at wellheads and at frack pads across the United States and around the world. And so the first thing that we did was look at, well, what are the proportions of those emissions from fracking, from oil development that can be attributed to plastics, and what's the scale of those emissions? The Frack Tracker Alliance led that piece of the work. And an important part of what they found was that in addition to the significant impacts of fracking and the for plastics and the significant greenhouse gas releases from that fracking and those operations, much of the climate impact of those operations is nearly impossible to quantify. It ranges from the climate impacts of the trucks that move fracking water and fracking sand and fracking waste down the pipelines to the leakage of methane from pipelines and compressor stations, many of which aren't even accurately counted in official government estimates.
So essentially your report is examining every aspect of the life cycle of plastic, from the very, you know, the extraction of the ingredients that are used to make the plastic all the way to its disposal, every part of the life cycle of a piece of plastic?
Exactly. And it doesn't end with the disposal of the plastics. I think a really fundamental finding of our report is that even after the usable life of a piece of plastic ends, its emissions don't. Those emissions go on sometimes in perpetuity. So after the plastics, you know, after the plastics leave the pipelines and the refineries, then they move into processing plants where they are responsible for massive greenhouse gas emissions. Turning feedstocks into plastic resins is extremely greenhouse gas intensive, both because of the energy it requires and because the chemical processes themselves are extremely high emitting. Even once those resins are made, however, the emissions from plastics and from the plastics life cycle continue. We see those emissions happen particularly at the end of the plastics life, when plastics are either buried in landfills, which is relatively low emitting, or recycled, which can save emissions because you're not producing new plastics from virgin material, or increasingly and very troublingly, when plastics are incinerated. And the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives, or GAIA, led this part of the research, and they actually commissioned a new economic life cycle analysis of how plastics are handled at the end of their lives and what emissions emerge from that. And I think this was one of the really surprising parts of our study, was the evidence that the rising reliance on plastic incineration in the name of waste to energy, which is pushed as a climate solution, can in fact actually dramatically increase the emissions from the plastics life cycle.
So who is incinerating plastic as a source of energy? Where is it happening, and why is it happening?
It is in fact happening increasingly worldwide. And the reasons for this are multifold. The first reason is that as if you look in the United States and you look in Europe, as China and other countries who have been absorbing plastic waste from the United States and Europe say no to new plastic waste and stop it at their borders, that is creating a crisis in the U.S. and elsewhere because we are now forced to deal with plastic waste at a scale that we don't have the infrastructure to do.
So essentially, and those of us, and I really like what you were saying earlier, that we need to be treating every piece of plastic as a piece of a petrochemical product. And so what you're saying is, you know, those of us, and we all of us are guilty of this, when we purchase things that have disposable plastic, you know, packaging or any other things, and we toss those, we feel that by tossing them into the recycling bin, we are being responsible. But because of the recent change in China's refusal to recycle plastics, now increasingly we have a glut of disposable plastic that, because it's not being recycled, is being burned and is creating even more greenhouse gas emissions.
China's refusal to accept our waste plastic exposed this problem. It didn't create
right.
it. And I think that's a really important thing to recognize. By it's for many, many years, only a tiny fraction of plastics are actually recycled. And for many years, the way that we define something as recycled in the US was the moment that a bale of plastic waste got on a barge or got on a freighter and was headed out of port to China, it was treated as recycled. But in fact, once that plastic waste got to China, what the Chinese companies and workers found in that waste was that only a small fraction of it was actually economically usable in any way. And the rest was what it had always been, trash. And so when China basically said, we're not taking your trash anymore, that's forced the US and Europe to really deal with this waste in completely new ways. And one consequence of this is, in the absence of better ways to recycle this massive flood of material, municipalities in the US and particularly in Europe are relying increasingly on incineration. And the irony is, this is often done in the guise of waste to energy and treated as a climate solution. One of the reasons that we wanted to focus a particular analysis on this report is that it is now clear that this incineration that's being done in the name of addressing climate change is actually contributing to it in really fundamental ways. Mm. But that incineration is only a small part of the growth that we're seeing in emissions from plastics. And that brings me back to the big overall story. And that is, when we looked at the life cycle emissions of plastics from the wellhead to the point where they became resins, and then we combined the emissions that come from rising reliance on incineration in plastic waste management, the scale of emissions becomes truly staggering. To give you one example, in 2019 alone, we estimate that emissions from plastic production and incineration will equal 850 million metric tons of CO2. That's equivalent to 129 coal-fired power plants operating around the clock all year long. But the plastic infrastructure, the infrastructure for making new plastics, is growing incredibly rapidly. The American Chemistry Council estimates that the industry will invest $200 billion in more than 330 new or expanded projects to produce plastics and petrochemicals
wow.
just in the next few years.
So we aren't we're at the stage where, instead of actually tackling the problem, unfortunately, we are projected to produce more and more and more plastic.
That's exactly right. And it's really, the figures are really dramatic. By 2030, this industry could be producing 1.34 gigatons of new plastics. To put that figure in perspective, you know, this is a massive increase in emissions from plastics at precisely the same time that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change tells us that we need to be cutting global emissions from greenhouse gases by 45%. And so plastics production and plastics incineration are moving in exactly the opposite direction. By 2050, the figures become even more stark. By 2050, we're looking at 2.8 gigatons of emissions from plastics every year, which is equivalent to 615 new coal-fired power plants. And if you look at the aggregate impact of those emissions, between now and 2050, the production and the incineration of plastics could release 56 gigatons of CO2 equivalent into the atmosphere. That's equivalent to 10 to up to 13% of the Earth's entire remaining carbon budget for staying below 1.5 degrees. And that's the target that the IPCC has recently urgently warned the world we cannot go beyond if the world is to have any hope of recovering from climate change.
So just ahead of your report, we heard the terrifying news that the observatory on Mauna Loa in Hawaii had recorded 415 parts per million of carbon dioxide levels in our atmosphere, a level not seen for 3 million years. It was last 3 million years ago that our Earth had such levels of carbon dioxide. Also recently released was a study in early May by the International Monetary Fund, and I don't know if you saw this, but it's relevant to this conversation we're having, that found that the subsidies received by the fossil fuel industry from the U.S. government, and so we're just talking about the U.S. alone, exceed that of our already far too high Pentagon budget. So we're subsidizing this deadly and destructive industry to such a huge extent that, even our military, you know, gets less funding than the fossil fuel industry if you measure it through subsidies.
That's exactly right. And I think in really fundamental ways, we as a society are being forced to subsidize our own destruction. A new study came out from the International Energy Agency, which also identified the petrochemical and plastics industry as a climate problem hiding in plain sight, as a blind spot in our response to climate change because of the massive growth in this industry and its tremendous capacity for emissions. One of the things that the International Energy Agency highlighted was that between now and 2050, the plastics and petrochemical industry will account for 50% of all of the demand growth for oil worldwide. In other words, 50% of the extra oil that we use between now and 2050 is going to go into petrochemicals. This isn't surprising because one of the things our research shows is that as global recognition of the need to transition away from fossil fuels for energy and transportation increases, the oil companies and gas companies, who are also not coincidentally the same companies who make plastics, Exxon, Chevron, Shell, Total, those companies are increasingly relying on petrochemicals and plastics to make their long-term business models add up.
So essentially, because they know that fossil fuels are being phased out and that people are coming to the realization, they're trying to sell the same destructive product to people in another way. In a way, they're relying on our ignorance of the plastic products in our day-to-day lives being linked to the same industry and having the same impact on our climate.
I think that's exactly right. And I think one of the things that we're seeing as is that as people begin to recognize that these problems are deeply linked, that the problem that the climate crisis and the plastics crisis, and indeed the toxic impacts that come from all of the additives that pervade a plastic economy, as people realize that these problems are all fundamentally linked at their source, it becomes clear that we can't respond to these problems in isolation. We have to deal with them together. And so, you know, that brings us to some of the fundamental findings and recommendations from
our
report.
Yes. What do you recommend?
What we recommend is that this is not a place where half solutions make sense. The most urgent need, that the world has already determined that we can't afford to use plastics at nearly the scale that we're using them. Their impacts are too dramatic, both on human health, on ecosystems, and now clearly on the climate. And yet, you know, industry is moving forward, moving ahead full speed in this massive new build out of plastics infrastructure. So the first challenge for us and the first and most urgent need is to stop that expansion of the infrastructure to make ever greater quantities of plastics. At the same time as we stop that build-out of new petrochemical infrastructure, we need to look at the root drivers of that build-out, and that is the massive supplies of oil and gas in our economy and the fact that companies are looking for what to do with that oil and gas. The IPCC has made clear that if we're going to address the climate crisis, the world needs to transition urgently and completely away from fossil fuels. And that means that the next and very fundamental step in addressing the plastic crisis is also the first step in addressing the climate crisis, and that is to keep fossil fuels in the ground in the first place. It's important to recognize that because plastics are essentially a byproduct of the production and refining of fossil fuels for transportation and energy, they are effectively subsidized by our reliance on fossil fuels for energy and transportation. And so if we start learning to keep fossil fuels in the ground, the economics of plastics production will itself fundamentally change. And when those economics change, we'll start to focus much more clearly on the plastics that the world absolutely has to have, and the much larger volume of plastics, the massive quantity of plastics that the world can't afford and doesn't need.
Right. So essentially, rather than saying no new fossil fuel, or let's transition away from fossil fuel energy to more sustainable energy, maybe the message needs to be no new oil and gas production, period. No extraction. Leave it in the ground, as a lot of activists have said. And then to your point around the issue of plastic waste and what is absolutely needed. We of course know that, for example, the medical industry uses plastic, and it can be a life-saving resource, if you will. There are, you know, people who rely on plastics for some very necessary things. So if we can change the way we treat plastic ourselves, from something to just buy and throw away, to something that is a very precious resource to be used minimally, we can transition our mindset, right?
I think that's right. And I think it's really important to recognize that, you know, more than 40% of the plastics that move through the economy and move through our lives come in the form of single-use disposable plastics, primarily plastic packaging.
And water bottles and all those unnecessary things that we just don't really need in our lives.
Exactly. And so there is a huge room for eliminating these plastics from our economy, from our lives, and from our ecosystems. And at the same time, it's important to recognize that those single-use disposable plastics and that plastic packaging are actually the major driver for the build-out of new plastic infrastructure. And so by—
So they're saying consumer demand is what's driving this.
Well, the industry likes to say that it is responding to consumer demand. What our research suggests is that plastics, to a far greater extent than virtually any other product or any other commodity, is actually a matter of supply driving demand rather than the opposite. You know, we are seeing this build out in new plastics infrastructure not because of a rising demand for plastics, but in fact because there's a massive glut of very cheap natural gas and natural gas feedstocks on the U.S. market that's been driven by the fracking boom. And the industry has been seizing on that glut of cheap feedstocks to build new infrastructure, not to serve U.S. markets, not to meet demand in the U.S., because there's actually a surplus of plastics in the U.S., but rather to increase its exports of plastics globally, with the particular goal of increasing consumption and increasing demand in the global south. Unfortunately for the industry, what they're likely to find is that in communities across the global south, and increasingly among governments in the global south, they are starting to recognize the impacts of plastics and starting to recognize that they, as governments and as communities, can no longer afford those impacts. And so the growth that the industry has been anticipating or hoping to create in plastics consumption in the global south, I think if you look at what's happening globally with the new the new recently adopted amendments to the Basel Convention just last week, and the progress that's been made towards a potential negotiation of a global agreement on plastics in Nairobi earlier this year. The leaders in those negotiations have been coming from the Global South, and they've been demanding solutions to this plastics crisis.
Right, because they see a lot of pollution of their lands and water as well. There have been many cities in the Global South that have banned plastic bags and other disposable, single-use disposable plastic items as well. So I'm wondering finally, Carol, whether you think that reports like this will add to the growing concern among populations else, you know, everywhere, here in the U.S. and outside, that we just have to end this reliance on plastic. I know there's pressure, you know, by consumers for grocery stores to phase out single-use plastic packaging. And certainly we've already seen plastic bag bans around the country. There have been plastic straw bans as well, although I know there's some concern among people from the disability rights community about the importance of and need for straws at restaurants. But it seems as though there is a growing concern from the public and awareness from the public.
I think there is growing concern, and I think there is growing recognition of the array of impacts, the array of prices we pay for the plastics that move through our lives, often unsolicited. And I think there's a growing recognition within the public that these crises, the climate crisis, the plastic crisis, the toxic economy that we face, that they are all deeply linked. And that brings me to, you know, one of the other goals that we had with this report was simply to better understand the scale of the impacts of plastics on the climate, because it's been a blind spot in our response to the plastics problem. And this brings me to one of the most troubling things to emerge from our report, and I'll have to say one of the most frightening things that I have seen in many years working on climate issues. We identified five gyres led the section of the report that looks at what happens to plastics once they're released out into the environment, in the oceans and in the landscape and beyond. And they found three fundamentally related things. First, microplastics, as they break down in the oceans, and there are 57 trillion particles of microplastics at the ocean surface. Those microplastics, as they break down in the oceans, they continue to release methane and other greenhouse gases more or less continuously. Even more importantly, not only are microplastics releasing greenhouse gases in the oceans, but the microplastics that occur on beaches and on shorelines and on agricultural lands and landscapes around the world are also off-gassing methane and other greenhouse gases at even faster rates. We don't yet understand the full scale of this problem, because it is very difficult to quantify the emissions that are happening, because we can only see a tiny, tiny fraction of a percent of the plastics that are at the surface and in the ocean.
I'll give out a website, Carol, where people can find information and read the report we've been discussing.
Yes, absolutely. People can find the report at our website. It's www.ciel.org. And people can stay abreast of the plastics news and all of the work that's going on to address the plastic crisis by following the hashtag #BreakFreeFromPlastics on Twitter and Facebook.
We'll link to those from our website. Thanks so much, Carol.
It was lovely talking with you.
My guest has been Carol Muffett, President and CEO of the Center for International Environmental Law. We've been discussing a new report about the climate impacts of plastics. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. and follow us on twitter.com/RUwithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up is an encore presentation of Preference, but first these messages.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle, every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at kboo.fm. The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work, to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle. Every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio.
They didn't decide how they can protect the animals or the environment or people more. Instead, they were like, well, how can we protect ourselves? And from that, they developed these protocols where prior to any large storm event, they're actually now locking all animals inside, boarding up the facilities and bolt locking them with multiple different devices so that nobody can get in and nobody can get out.
You were just listening to Elizabeth Jones, also known as Ethically Elizabeth. She is an animal rights activist, a rescuer, marine biologist, and a conservationist. You can catch this episode of Voices for the Animals on December 27th at 10 a.m. right here on KBOO, or anytime after the 27th on kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals, also on Google Play and iTunes.